Greetings, horror fans, and welcome to episode 223 of Frightmares. I am your host, Austin Proctor, and joining me today is a good buddy of mine, Michael Viers.
Hello and welcome.
Ooh, a little dance going along with it.
Doing a little
dance, jig.
Yeah. I was going to do like the Gabby style of delivery and just be like, hi.
Hey. That's what Spencer does too. Spencer and Gabby's like, hey. Corey goes, hey, yo, hey, yo. And you're just like, yeah, vibing. I like it.
I've been listening to a lot of your shows, so I'm starting to learn what all your co-hosts do.
Yeah, there's a different energy with every host. Me and Corey get very hyper and animated. Me and Spencer, he usually just has a bunch of fun facts, which is what you also bring. And then me and Gabby usually just end up bickering about something, and it's different.
And I feel like you and Mike are usually button heads about the movie selection. Yes. So, and then I've only listened to one episode thus far of Aid.
Oh, she's actually, well, she was only, me and her did Alice Sweet Alice, and then she was on a couple last year where with me and Mikey where we did our top 12 Christmas movies, and then I think she was on another, oh, Satan's Little Helper. So
she was also on Lords of Salem, which is the one I'm with.
Yes, yes. So she comes over every now and again. I typically go over and on slashers, but every now and again, Aid will pop over, and she's a lot of fun to talk to. So today starts the first episode of Slashtober. This is like, I don't know, year three or four that we've been doing this. We're starting with a movie called Torso, and I did a whole bunch of research because I wanted to talk about where the first slasher movie started, and I knew that this was a giallo, or at least came in my giallo box set, and we have an affinity for these movies. You were on the Tenebrae episode, which we really enjoyed, so I figured I'd bring you on. I've got this article here, and we're going to kind of talk it out and see if it makes sense.
I also love slashers, so this is a joint Slashtober, G-Locktober.
G-Locktober.
Extravaganza,
yes,
if you will.
So I found this. We're not going to do any horror news today because we're going to be talking origins of what defines a slasher movie. And in all of my research, this is a great article. It's from PaceMagazine.com, written by Jim Vorel. And I'm taking a lot of what he has to say based on that he's knowledgeable, because I haven't seen all of these movies that he listed. But the ones I have seen, the way he described them, I'm like, I 100% agree with these. So, and I agreed with this one so much. And even after watching Torso, I was like, I do agree with this article like 100%. So I'm curious to see your feelings on it, because a lot of people think that like Halloween was the first slasher. And it definitely probably was the most successful slasher and paved the way for the 80s. I'm not going to argue that 100%. But, you know, I'd argue that Black Christmas 4 years before 74, right? Black Christmas. Yeah.
Black Christmas was always kind of my touchstone.
Yeah, honestly.
That was kind of always the one that I would choose. And I feel like part of me almost feels like I still want to go with that, but we could talk about that.
Yeah, and like I said, typically giallos, I don't know if I said this already, but typically giallos are very focused on the crime and like portion of the, you know, there's usually detectives and all this stuff, like Tenebrae, very, very crime driven. And there was not a lot of that in this at all. I mean, there was a detective, or an inspector, I think he said his name was, on the case, but that was like in the background. And that's kind of one of the slasher rules, I guess, is that it's not so heavily focused on crime or like the crime side of things, like the investigations and shit like that, which I agree. So we're going to get into this. We're going to talk about what defines a slasher movie. There's, you know, there's rules that go along with slashers, and then there's 10 proto slashers, which I had to look up. Essentially, it is the earliest form of a slasher, which the subgenre was built on and eventually fleshed out to be what we know today. And then that leads up to Torso being dubbed as the first true slasher that follows all of the rules that we're going to lay out. So all of the movies we're going to talk about, they follow some of the rules, but they don't follow all of them. So this was the first movie to follow all of the 6 rules that we have. So we should probably just get into this, because this is going to take not a while, but it's going to take a minute. So
Do you think we should just break down his rules and then the films?
Yeah, I think we should set out the 6 points that he says. I'll read them, you know, bullet point by bullet point. We can discuss after, and then we'll list each movie. I don't know if I'm going to read everything that he laid out for the movies, but we can.
Yeah, I think we can just, you can just kind of skim over it. He bolds the most important part of it.
Yeah. So let's start off here with what is a slasher movie. First of all, it should be noted that slasher villains are human beings or were human beings at some point. A giant bug is not a slasher, nor is the shark in Jaws. The behavior of a beast can be forgiven as it's only performing as nature designed it. Slasher villains are human killers whose actions are objectively, quote, evil because they're meant to be bound by human morality. That's part of the fear that the genre is meant to prey on, the idea that killers walk among us. To put us in the killer's shoes, slasher movies often feature sequences from the killer's POV, as made famous in the sequences like the opening of Halloween. So, yes, they either, like Jason, you know what I mean? Like, he was human at one point and then turned into a like hulking beast by, you know, like the seventh movie. Michael Myers was, and still, you know, I mean, he's unkillable, but he was a kid that went to a mental asylum and blah, blah, blah. So your villain has to be a human being or was at one point. Which I agree with. Yeah, like a giant bug or like animals, those wouldn't be considered slashers. Moving down to this second rule, if you will. Slasher killers choose to kill or are compelled to kill for the thrill or for revenge, but mostly because they're filled with indiscriminate evil. Yes, yeah. 100% agree. And so far, Torso has followed both of these rules.
I would argue that second one a little bit, but not enough that I'm going to discredit it.
Yeah, because the killer in Torso is definitely, I'd say out of all those, it's probably for revenge because of what he went through, and we'll get there. But yeah, this one is a little loose for this Torso, but it does still kind of fit.
Which is the reason why, like I said before, that like is the, almost the reason I still would go with Black Christmas, just because the killer absolutely has no motive. but you know, that's just now we're just splitting hairs. But yeah. I will say all the points he makes a compelling argument that Torso is definitely, you know,
the first one to follow the rules that he's laid out.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
some are rational, many are completely psychotic, but they're all monsters. They don't tend to be sympathetic or behave with empathy or logic. Importantly, their killings are inspired by drives that are easy for the audience to understand, such as greed, personal advancement, or to protect someone else. Like, I'm pretty sure the motive in Tenebrae, wasn't it greed? I can't remember exactly. Yeah, that one was greed. So, you know, Tenebrae, and plus that was a very crime-heavy giallo, like, detective movie. So that one doesn't really fit into this. So slashers don't kill a dozen people because they're trying to find a diamond or win an inheritance. They kill because they want to kill or feel compelled to kill. Anyone could become a victim. This is an important distinction that will separate crime and giallo films from slasher films. So that is the second point that Jim Vorell makes. Third point, slasher films have a body count. I don't even need to read everything else that he points out, but like one or
they
two
should have a body count.
Yeah. Yep. One or two kills is not enough. You need like three or more in my opinion, you need at least three because that's when they consider you a serial killer is three or more. So, and this movie has like fucking 10, I think if my count is accurate, there's 10. So that's a huge body count for a slasher movie. Slasher girls tend to have a final girl or a stand-in who is the paragon of virtue to balance out the pure evil of the antagonist. The killer literally says to one of the girls in this movie that I didn't want to kill you because you are pure and you know, like whatever. And he eventually does try to kill her. But, slashers have a final girl. And for the longest, dude, for this whole fucking movie, I'm like, who the fuck is going to be the final girl? I thought it was going to be one. And then I was like, okay, maybe it's going to be her. And then end up being the first girl that I fucking thought it was going to be in the beginning. So,
yeah, they didn't make that really clear for a while.
That is my biggest problem with this movie. I think it follows all the rules, but there's I have a few problems with Torso. So slasher number five here. Slasher films are structured around graphic killings. They tend to take place over short periods of time in remote locations that are far from help, which Torso follows to a T. they're at a, I mean, it doesn't feel like the first half, but then they end up at that, you know, countryside like cabin or whatever, which is way up the hill. So
way up the hill
so far. That's number five. And the sixth and final one here is because the killings tend to happen over short periods in secret, we rarely follow the police or detective investigations in true slasher movies. This is, again, something that's going to differentiate Italian giallo films from slashers, as these crime thrillers often join inspectors or detectives on cases, examining bodies, questioning witnesses, yada, yada, yada. And that's, and yeah, there is a, like, that's not to say that your slasher movie cannot have any detective at all. It's just, you know, and this one, it started out like, I was like, okay, this is going to be way more crimey than I thought. But really, that is such a background to Torso. So those are the six rules. I feel that Torso follows all of these rules. Now, the 10 notable proto slashers that some people, you know, like, and that's the thing. Some people think, like, the first one is Psycho from 1960. Now, this isn't a slasher to me, because I agree with exactly what he's saying. There's no real body count. Psycho focuses on Norman Bates, who's been, you know, like, terrorized by his mother. And then eventually, you know, it's the whole reveal.
And it's kind of interesting, too, because Norman Bates, spoiler for guys, people haven't fucking seen Psycho.
It's fucking 60-something years old.
Yeah. I feel like Psycho is one of those movies you know the twist on.
Yeah.
You don't know the movie.
That's true.
Hell, Mrs. Doubtfire spoils the fucking twist.
Does it really?
The first time that Robin Williams sees himself in a wig, he goes, oh, Norman Bates.
Oh, yeah. You gotta love when another movie spoils a different movie. Oh my god!
But like, it's kind of an interesting film because one could argue, depending on how you read that ending of the film, that Norman Bates doesn't even realize he's killing anyone.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, so
yeah.
It's an interesting film.
It's a very good film. I love that movie. I think it's a masterpiece. Alfred Hitchcock is a fucking genius. But this is more of a psychological movie, and you're meant to empathize with Norman. Like, you're meant to feel bad for him. You're not supposed to feel bad for slashers. You're also not going to find a genuine slasher movie with a 10-minute emotionally forthcoming parlor conversation between victim and killer. And there's not even the only real...
And that's a shame. There needs to be more of those.
There should be more of those. Yeah, and there's not even, you know, there's not really even, the killings are not really the central draw of the film, and there's only one bloody one, and that's the infamous shower scene that everyone should know.
Yeah.
So that's the first proto-slasher on this list from 1960, Psycho. Next, we have Peeping Tom, also from 1960, which is compared invariably to Hitchcock's more famous work. Indeed, like Psycho, Peeping Tom more correctly deserves to be filed under psychological thriller and drama. Especially because the character of Mark Lewis is perhaps even more sympathetic than Norman Bates, as the suffering he endured under his cruel father. So again, you're supposed to feel sorry for Mark Lewis and his character. And this is another one that I've seen that I agree with. So this doesn't really fit the slasher mold, as you're not going to find a slasher villain striking up a potential romance with a woman in his apartment building or reminiscing about his childhood. So
shame,
shame. We need more of this. Where is this subgenre of slashers but not slashers? So yeah, that's the second one. And going on to the third one is Blood Feast, Herschel Gordon Lewis, 1963. And I'm not saying that any of these movies are bad in any way. Like, all three of these all three of these, the first three movies are fucking solid fucking movies. We're distinctly talking about what defines the, you know, the slasher genre. Because Blood Feast is way more of a splatter film than anything. And it's about a crazy chef who kills people.
And I believe his argument for Blood Feast, or against Blood Feast, is, well, it has the body count, it has the gore, it has the whole idea of a killer killing just because he likes to kill.
Yeah.
It definitely becomes more of a police story.
Yeah, so what's much more of a crime film, and there's no final girl, and it largely follows the police. That's one that again doesn't really necessarily fit the six rules that were laid out. The presentation of the deaths is significantly more slasher-like in the, you know, compared to like Psycho and stuff like that. But outside the deaths, none of the connective tissue fits the genre. The end result is nasty and crude, but it's no slasher. This is one going down to one that I have not actually seen, and that's
I know of this movie. I'm very familiar with it, but
I've never seen Straitjacket. It's by William Castle from 1964. I'm going to kind of read into this one a little bit more just because, you know, I had never even heard of this one, to be honest. So I guess William Castle is a shameless king of horror gimmicky, or gimmickry. I don't think that's a word. He could not resist trying to put his own spin on Hitchcock, which resulted in this Joan Crawford starring film combining the psychological identity themes of Psycho with the expectations of the emerging psycho biddy genre following 1962's Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Throw in a series of axe murders, and it's fair to question if this would qualify as a slasher movie. This one falls victim to the killer's motivations being very unslasher-like, as the crimes eventually lead to a desire to frame someone for personal reasons. So that's not something a slasher would do. They're not out for anything to, you know, personal desires. They're out to just kill people to kill people, essentially. So that one does not technically follow all the rules. Now, this next one I have seen, and it's a great movie, Blood and Blacklist.
This one I've actually not seen.
It is so good. Mario Bava, 1964. Probably one of the most influential giallo ever made. Mario Bava's Blood and Black Lace is a sumptuous-looking film that initially plays very much like a slasher. It has a cast of nubile young ladies, all of whom are stalked by a shadowy masked figure. It has long, drawn-out sequences of pursuit and killing that would fit right in with later slashers. The film, however, has no final girl because it more or less kills off all of its protagonists by the time we reach the third act. So Blood and Black Lace eventually shifts its focus onto the killers themselves, revealing that their motivations are quite concrete and logical. They kill for money, for love, and due to personal betrayal. So again, no final girl, killing because they want something. Great giallo film, not technically a slasher, according to the rules, again, laid out. So that's one I need to rewatch because I really enjoyed that one. This is another one I have not seen, and I don't think you've seen either. It's called 10 Little Indians, George Polak, 1965. Pollock. It's actually an adaptation. What did I say? Polak?
Yeah.
Idiot. Pollock.
I have not seen this, but I've seen a lot of adaptations of the story of 10 Little Indians.
Yes, because it is a adaptation of Agatha Christie's 1939 detective novel of the same name. This one brings a bunch of people together in a remote location where they're killed one by one. 10 Little Indians, though, has more in common with an old dark house or mastermind revenge in the mold of 1939's The Man They Could Not hang, and that the killings are title. And that the killings are to some degree justified by the fact that the victims are revealed to be criminals themselves. So I probably should have prefaced this with spoilers. I'll go ahead and throw that in the description. So in the episode description. So yeah, again, something that slightly falls short of what a slasher movie is. So after reading all the six rules, is there anything that you would add to the rules that he laid out? I know, I'm throwing you on the spot because I was thinking about it. I'm like, I don't think there's anything that I would add. I think those are pretty dead set rules, honestly.
I don't know. I guess if I was going to add anything, and it's not to say that this is needed, but I think it helps differentiate your film from being like a slash film versus a non-slash film. I think some sort of trying to think of the best way to word this. You really did throw me in the spot.
I'm struggling with
words right now. some sort of way to identify the killer.
Okay.
Most movies will use a mask or something like that. But, you know, in a case of, say, like Black Christmas, he doesn't really have him. We don't ever see what he looks like. But we have, the phone calls. And
I think
that something like that.
Okay, I can agree with that. Because, yeah, this they do usually have some sort of defining something, like in this
so many giallo films just have a pair of black gloves,
right? And that's all like
you see.
That's
and
like,
which that could definitely count,
right?
That became more of a trend of the genre,
right?
Whereas, like I said, not to say that all slashers need to have a mask, but I think some way to identify your killer
without showing
is
face.
Definitely And that's usually a great reveal later on because they usually use the killer POV shot throughout most of it. And then you get the reveal later on of the mask, or you get glimpses of it. I think that's, if anything, maybe I put that as rule number 7 to how to make an iconic slasher.
Okay. Yeah. I like that. A little asterisk on the bottom to make it, to take it to the next level. I think I like that.
Because your fucking sprinkles on top.
Yeah. Okay. Cause this one definitely has that. You have the scarf in this movie. You have the black gloves. You have the really creepy mask. Like, I don't even know what it was. It just looked like a sheet
fucked up ski mask.
Yeah, yeah. It was horrifying. So,
and like when I wrote a slasher film years ago and I wouldn't even write it until I came up with a mask.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that should be added. Okay, I like that. Four more here. We've got Fright. This is one I have not seen. Peter Collinson, 1971. So this movie follows a babysitter character, much like Halloween, and she receives threatening phone calls, which is funny because that predates Black Christmas by about 3 years. It's certainly a horror film, but it stops short of slasher, notably because it has no body count and only a single killing. So that's why this one doesn't technically count. No body count. Moving down to Bay of Blood, a.k.a. Twitch of the Death Nerve by Mario Bava, 1971, which is so funny because when I was filling this out, I was like, Twitch of the Death Nerve, that's a podcast on Cinepunks. I love that name. I was like, yeah. I love that name so much. So have you seen this one?
No.
Okay. So again, this is more in the way of giallo. It doesn't really fit the slasher mold here. A Bay of Blood starts to disqualify itself when there's no real final girl, just like Blood and Black Lace. It ends up being a film about a bunch of self-destructible, greedy people without a true protagonist. So no final girl, bunch of people that are out for something. So this one, again, just falls short. Moving down to number 9 here, we have Frenzy, Alfred Hitchcock, 1972. I love how Bava and Hitchcock made this list twice. So, 1972, Hitchcock's second-to-last feature, has many of his hallmarks, including a wrongfully accused protagonist, except this time around, the crime is a serial murderer. The great director definitely took some cues from the popularity of giallo at the time, and Frenzy plays very much like a British version of the genre. It has no final girl, as its protagonist is a man framed by the killer, which also happens to be his friend. So yes, there is a killer with motives and a conscience and framing someone. So that is where this one slightly falls short. It is essentially much more of a crime thriller about a grudge between friends than a slasher movie. Finally on the list here, we have number 10, Home for the Holidays. Have not seen this one either. John
Llewellyn.
Llewellyn. Oh, that is a fun, but hard to... Looking at that, I'm like, holy shit. Llewellyn, Moxie, 1972. It comes very close to meeting all of the slasher criteria. It is an obscure TV horror movie which revolves around a family patriarch, Walter Brennan. Walter Brennan, who believes his second wife is plotting to kill him. He summons his daughters to the family mansion, but when they arrive, people start dying one by one, attacked by a mystery figure and a yellow rain slicker. Very Alice, Sweet Alice-esque. So this does, the disguised killer has a particularly slasher feel, possessing the sort of unique look essential for the genre, but the motivations for the killings are eventually revealed to be primarily family drama and greed. So a lot of these movies that are on this list that fall short are almost all because of, you know, it's motive-driven greed or it's no final girl, you know, so they're like so close. Like the article goes on to say, maybe we're like 90% of the way there, which I agree with. That one sounds like a lot of fun. What's this one called?
Yeah, that one I've never even heard of, but I do know the director.
Okay.
The director actually did the movie The Night Stalker, which would eventually go on to be the TV show. And he also directed a couple episodes of a British TV show called The Avengers.
Oh, okay. Llewellyn. I like that name. So, finally, we arrive at the first slasher movie to fit all of the 6 points and even the 7th point that you made.
That's true.
So finally we have arrived at Torso, Sergio Martino, 1973. It's a giallo and not well known. Really, I mean, I had not even heard about this movie.
Surprised when I read that because I've known about this movie for a long time. Everyone did.
Interesting.
But that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. So it's not from Bava. It's not Argento, Fulci. No, it's Sergio Martino by a nose. So Torso takes place in central Italy with a spat of killings at a college campus that it leads to a group of risque, sexually promiscuous young women sequestering themselves in a remote country mansion until the crimes blow over. So that's your location that is kind of off the beaten path because it's way up the hill. And people in the movie actually mention, like, you should fix that road. It's a bitch to get up here. Like, so
essentially what they're saying, you know, more Italian.
So little do they know they've been followed into the countryside by a masked killer who proceeds to stalk one girl in particular, Jane, trapping her in the home with all her friends as they are murdered and dismembered. torso has all of the little flourishes you expect in a genuine slasher, killer POV shots, graphic killings, secluded location, constant themes of voyeurism, a mass killer, an actual final girl, and finally you have a killer whose initial crimes are revealed to have been for logical, if deeply misogynistic, reasons. When that happened, I was like, wow, so you just hate women. Alrighty then. So he's not seeking a payoff or an inheritance. He is out for revenge. So, you know, on its own merits, Torso is an impressive and attractively shot film, brimming with disturbed personality and featuring some lovely location shooting in the Italian countryside. The first half does lean towards the traditional giallo mystery, but things take a turn for full-on slasher, culminating the kind of cat-and-mouse game between killer and final girl that you'd expect from the genre as a killer toys with a young woman by allowing her to think that perhaps she has not been detected. As the tagline goes, Torso, it saturates the screen with terror. Love that tagline. That is fucking great.
That is a great tagline. Yeah. Holy shit.
And I love how this article goes on to say, terror is by no means a masterpiece, nor is it the gold standard for slasher tropes. The final girl, for instance, doesn't participate in much of the killer's defeat. But even Laurie Strode was saved by Dr. Loomis on Halloween. It's a true slasher and a giallo all at once, much as Michelle Soavi's Stage Fright would be in 1987. If you consider yourself a student of slasher history, Torso is a film to immediately place on your to-do list. And I agree. It's not the greatest movie, honestly. It's not even my favorite giallo. Not my favorite slasher at all. Like, I did enjoy it, but we have things that I did not like. There was a few things I was like, I don't like this. So
mm-hmm. I gave you the review that I did.
Yes. Because I was like, you were like, I enjoyed it, but not as much as I wanted to. And I was like, oh, I feel like I'm going to feel the same way. And that's exactly how I felt.
I shouldn't have said anything. I shouldn't have set up your expectations.
No. You're fine. Like, you're totally fine. I was kind of, because it has such a great rating. But I'm like, I just, for some reason, I got this vibe that I wasn't going to love it, even before you told me that you like enjoyed it, but not as much as you wanted to. So yeah. Anything else to add before we move on to the IMDb roundup here and then review said movie?
I like slasher
films. I like slashers. They're good. All right. So
No, it's honestly it. Like, this is a genre that I like. It's deeply flawed as it can be, and deeply problematic and as it can be. But I think there's a lot of interesting artifice that comes from it. And you have a film like what we're going to be talking about today that rides this really kind of beautiful line between art house and grindhouse.
Yeah.
Where it's like the filmmaker has an eye for art house cinema, but has like $50 in a Slim Jim to do it.
That's a beautiful explanation. I love that. Very well said. Very well said. I agree with everything that you just said 100%. So let's go to the IMDb summary roundup here. Whip crack. Torso from 1973 was actually not released until March 21st of 1975 in the U.S. It is rated R for severe sex and nudity, severe violence and gore, mild profanity, moderate alcohol, drugs, and smoking, and moderate frightening and intense scenes. Coming in at the version I watched was an hour 29. IMDb says an hour 32. I assume that might be the original Italian cut. Not sure. There's four versions you can watch on the Arrow Blu-ray. We watched what did we watch, Michael?
We watched the Torso cut with English dubs.
Yes.
There, hold on. I actually have the picture in front of me. Well, not quite, but there is four versions. Yes, there is a original Italian version, which has the carnal violence title, or its full fucking title of The Bodies Bear Traces of Carnal Violence. There's a hybrid English Italian version, which I believe is primarily the English version. But they've added back in the extra footage, and since there's no dub for that, it cuts to Italian.
Oh. And
then there's an English version of Carnal Violence, so just pretty much the title card changes, and then there's the English version with the Torso titles.
The Torso titles. I like that. That's what we want.
Torso titles.
Yeah, Torso titles. So
it's like Austin asked me to be on this show to talk about Torso, not Carnal Violence.
Yeah, we're doing the Torso cut. So I'm going to say it's an hour 29 because that's how long mine was. This is listed as a crime, horror, mystery, thriller directed by Sergio Martino, who's also directed All the Colors of the Dark, Your vice is a locked room, and only I have the key. Which we've, which we went over on our Tenebrae episode when you were reading all those fucking crazy titles, and yeah. Hands of Steel. He also wrote this. He wrote a lot of what he directed, but only Hands of Steel out of what I just mentioned. Then we've got also written by Ernesto Gastaldi, who also wrote Death Walks on High Heels, All the Colors of the Dark, Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key, Death Walks at Midnight, Hands of Steel, and is uncredited for the screenplay of Once Upon a Time in America, which I just edited for you recently. I thought that was funny. I had to throw that in there. So,
yeah.
Because wasn't there like 17 writers on that movie or some shit?
Yeah, who would have thought the same guy who did The Whip in the Body would also do Once Upon a Time in America. The Scorpion of Two Tails.
Yeah, that's
the enough. Cynic, the Rat, and the Fist.
Oh, is that another Sergio?
No, that was a Umberto Lenzi film.
There's too many Umbertos. You have Umberto Bava, Umberto Lenzi, and then Umberto something else. There's so many Umbertos. Yeah, there's like three of them. Where was I? Oh, composed by Guido De Angelis, who has 193 credits and composed many of Sergio's other movies. We also have composed by Maurizio De Angelis, probably brothers. They work together frequently, and he had 201 credits. Like, holy shit. Cinematography by Giancarlo Ferrando, who has 119 credits. Did the cinematography for All the Colors of the Dark, Your Vice, Hands of Steel.
Pretty much all of,
most
Martino's
of
films. Yeah,
a lot of these guys worked, like the composers, the cinematographer, and the editor are like, they all worked on a lot of movies, because even the editor, Eugenio Alibiso, 183 credits, also did The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, All the Colors of the Dark, Hands of Steel, and many other Sergio films. So they did a lot. They cranked out a lot of fucking movies together is what we're getting at. We've got Tina Almont as Daniela Anselmi, who was also in Texas Across the River as Lunetta. Luke Miranda as Roberto, who was also in Hostel Part 2 as the Italian detective. I have some fun trivia on that guy. John Richardson as Franz, who was in 1 Million Years BC as Tumac. And then we have Robert Bisacco as Stefano Vanzi, who was also in the very controversial Romeo and Juliet 1968 as Lord Paris.
There was also another actor in here that didn't have a huge career as an actress. It was Conchita Eroldi.
Yeah, what'd she do?
She played a character by the name of Carol Peterson.
Oh, yeah, Carol. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, she was in this and a couple other things. But what I find interesting is she produced some big films. She produced Fat Girl. She produced one of Argento's newer films, from last year, Dark Glasses.
Oh yeah,
she produced the movie Titus. So like, interesting. She produced some pretty big films.
Okay,
and I love that she was in this.
Yeah, I liked Carol. That's cool though.
Carol's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah. Yeah, Carol was great. So estimated budget of NA, could not find anything. Worldwide box office gross of $735,600. This was filmed in, I'm so sorry if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, L'Aquila, Perugia, and Rome, Italy. So it is on location in Italy. You can watch this so many ways. You can watch this on AMC+, Fandor, Screenbox, Tubi, or buy the Arrow release singularly, or get the Giallo Essential yellow box, which also comes with...
I missed out on my chance to get that, because that's out of print now, right?
Is it?
I don't know. I'm asking.
I don't think so. I got it recently.
Oh.
Yeah,
maybe I have a chance then.
This also comes with What Have They Done to Your Daughters and Strip Nude for Your Killer.
Oh, some
scandalous man, titles.
I know what I'm getting into with that box set, and I need a shower.
What Have They Done to Solange? That's one you read on Tenebrae's episode.
Yes.
Movies that came out around the
same. What Have They Done to Her?
The direct quote was, you read it as, what have they done to Solange? And I was like, question mark? And you were like, yeah, question mark. Like, Jesus, who doesn't love a title with a question mark in the title?
Fun fact, I love titles with punctuation.
Yes.
Of any sort.
Commas, exclamation like, points, question marks.
Give me an ellipsis and I'm going to fucking lose my mind. Yeah.
Dot, dot, dot.
The title keeps going.
There's more. Oh my god, so much air just went out of my body. I got lightheaded from laughing so hard. Okay, so movies that came out around the same time, we've got Rollerball, Shampoo, Deep Red, Death Race 2000, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and the return of the Pink Panther.
What a weird year.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot. I had to go a few months out because there was not much released around the same time. Specific horror moments, is there one you had in particular?
Yes, I would say... Slasher films are inherently not scary, even though they scared the shit out of me when I was a kid, funny enough. But it's very rare that they have good atmosphere or good, just a good creepiness to them.
Right.
But that fucking sequence in the woods with Carol.
Yes.
Where the killer's just kind of like coming through the fog.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was so well done. And that was one of those moments where it was like art house sensibilities. Yes. But he's shooting it like a grindhouse movie.
That is a very good way to describe this movie, honestly. It is a weird combination of art house and grindhouse. This copy that we have, it looked fucking gorgeous. This movie looks so good. I was very impressed.
I almost had little hope for it because, like, since I watched the torso cut,
oh yeah,
when they brought up the titles, I'm like, oh man, these titles are rough. But then you had to like this great like guitar solo.
Yep.
When torso came up and then the movie started, and like, oh shit, this does look really good.
Yeah. They added that beginning thing in for that cut, and it was from like a VHS rip, and I was like, that makes sense.
However, I gotta say, as an aspect ratio nerd, this movie's in my favorite aspect ratio of 1.66:1, which is the European widescreen.
Yes. I'm pretty sure the Witch was shot in 1.66, if I'm correct.
Yep, and my film No Soliciting was made in 1.66:1.
Oh, so this is literally your favorite. I like that.
Yes, it's legitimately my favorite. Also, the first couple James Bond films, like Dr. No, were in that aspect ratio. I love it. It's my favorite aspect.
Yeah,
ratio.
little bars on the left and right, not on the top and bottom. My specific horror moment is when Stefano comes to the countryside house. And they open the door, and he's just sitting there, like, wide-eyed, and you're like, is he going to talk or say something?
Yeah.
And then he just falls over, and the killer's behind him. I was like, oh, fake out. What the fuck?
Yeah, that was great, because I was like, Stefano's the killer? That's too easy. And then he fell. I'm like, ah!
Yeah, he's so clearly a red herring. I don't buy this for a second, but I was like, what's going on? Favorite kill, was there one that stood out to you? I feel like we're going to have the same one for the kill. Or, I don't know.
I'm struggling with that one because I feel like for a movie that had such a body count, very few of the kills were that memorable.
I like the car kill the best. That guy got
fuck, I forgot about the car kill. Yes, because I was actually saying to Amanda, like, man, more slasher films need people getting run down by cars.
Yeah, it's very P2-esque if you've seen P2, where the guy gets...
P2 is fucking underrated as
shit. Oh, it's very underrated. It's solid Christmas horror.
But no, that scene was great because, like, once again, going back to my... you know, art house, but treated like a, you know, drive-in movie type of stuff. I keep changing the way I describe it, but it's all the same shit. That scene, it's like, this scene feels dangerous.
Yes.
I can guarantee you they don't have, if they have a stunt coordinator, it's not much of one. However, that scene was funny too, because my wife Amanda was watching with me, and she's like, sometimes high definition hurts us.
Yeah.
I was like, why? She's like, I think I saw the killer. And I don't know if it's supposed to be the killer or a stunt driver just looks like, has a very specific look. And thinking about it, it's like, the driver did kind of look like the killer.
Yeah, he wasn't wearing a mask. I was like, oh, I can see his face. And then I quickly looked away. I was like, I don't want to know if that was not supposed to be. So my favorite character was Daniela. I don't know why. She just gave me Mia Goth vibes for some reason. And I thought she was going to be the final girl for a while. We start in on Jane, but then Daniela kind of takes over as like the lead for a bit because you follow her around. And I'm like, oh, she's going to be the final girl. No, it's fucking Jane. Jane's the final girl. I was like, what the shit?
Yeah. Tina Almond, who played her, she's great in this. I definitely get the... The Mia Goth, or even who's the woman from The Witch?
Oh, Anya Taylor-Joy.
I can almost get a little bit of that from her too.
Yeah, I don't know. She just
Favorite character though is Carol.
Carol's a good character.
Conchita Eraldi. I don't know. I was just charmed by her.
Okay.
Yeah.
Probably the same way I was charmed by Daniela. I did not really have a least favorite character or a favorite line, so I have nothing for those. I don't know if you do. If not, we can just move on to talking
for
about
favorite lines. Oh. I kind of do.
Oh, okay.
For least favorite character, I would say that gaggle of pervy men that were slightly racist shit to the one black character.
They were. I was like, wow, okay. Yeah, they were like gawking her in the village, and then they started saying some very kind of inappropriate things. I was like, wow. Like,
yeah. hold on. I'm trying to find my notes where that line that I liked was. I tend to just take screenshots of things and then I don't remember where anything came from.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine.
So what happens? You take too many screenshots, Michael. You can't ever find what you're looking for, Michael. I can't control the weather, Jackie. Okay, I found him.
All right.
Okay, my two favorite lines is death is the best keeper of secrets.
Oh, okay.
And then I feel like I wrote it down, so it must have been said in the film. I could have sworn the killer describes the women as dolls made out of flesh and blood. It's a creepy way to describe someone.
Yeah, that's pretty unsettling. All right. Well, IMDb summary: a string of appalling lust murders shocks the University of Perugia as a sadistic killer, as a sadistic serial killer strangles to death beautiful college girls with a red and black scarf. So, yes, we've already kind of brushed on this movie this entire, episode so far, but, you focus, I'd say you've got Jane, you've got Carol, you've got Daniela, you've got Ursula, and you've got the other one that I cannot remember. Those are like the five main girls. They all end up at the country home. Who was the guy? Was it her uncle that told her to go, Daniela, to go to the country home? Is that who that was?
I believe so. Pervy uncle. Yeah, actually, that's my least favorite character. Fuck that guy.
Yeah, because he, at one point, he's like looking through at Daniela and her friend Jane when like Daniela's almost naked. And he's just sitting there like looking through. And I'm like, if you're her uncle, you're fucking a pervert, dude. And for the longest time, I thought the killer was going to be him because, I knew that Stefano was the red herring. It's blatantly obvious that he's the red herring.
It's also tough because I think me and Amanda were joking around when we were watching this movie that every man in this movie is ugly as hell. And they all kind of look the same.
I had such a hard time distinguishing the men. I kept
getting so many of the male characters confused.
Dude, same. I had to like look up all these names because I'm like, who the fuck is who? And finally they would be like, oh, Stefano. And I'm like, ah, there we go. Okay, because you look at their IMDb picture and a lot of them don't look anything like their picture. So I'm like, who the fuck are these men? So Stefano is very obviously the red herring. I knew that from the beginning. And I still don't know. I have to ask you who the killer was. Was the killer the teacher? Is that who that was? The professor?
Do you want to put like a spoiler warning before we talk about that?
Oh yeah, the spoiler warning is going to be in the it's going to be
okay. Well, anyways, the killer is the teacher Franz, guy who is teaching them about art and shit.
Yeah. Okay. So I knew Stefano was a red herring, and I had it pegged as the uncle, honestly, because I was like, the teacher seems a little too obvious, but I was like, it seems like it would be the uncle because he's kind of pervy looking in on Daniela, and he's...
Every character feels too obvious in this film.
That's true, because even the uncle at one point's like, I'm going to be in Paris, so that felt like a very obvious... I'm going to be in Paris. I couldn't possibly be the murderer, and then when
wink,
it's...
Wink, wink.
Yeah. And then
especially because they had that line later on, which I know this was thrown in as a red herring thing, where what is her name? Danny? The Danny, Tina Almond's character. Yeah. Her uncle apparently calls her and she's like, oh, you're in Paris? It sounds like you're in the next room over.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, maybe.
I was like, that's a weird piece of dialogue.
And that's when I was like, okay, maybe it's not the uncle. And then I was trying to think, I was like, it's not Stefano. It's not the uncle. And I was like, maybe it's that doctor guy who was on the train with them and then eventually comes to help Jane because she like hurt her leg. I was like, maybe it's the doctor.
The doctor who I described as high cheekbones Tommy Lee Jones.
Yes.
He looks like a young Tommy Lee Jones.
Very high cheekbones. Yes. He had a very like intense face. So I'm thinking it's him because the fucking teacher is in so little of this movie. He's in like the first 15 minutes and you fucking, at least I completely forgot about him.
I am learning with giallo films, you have the obvious character who's the red herring.
Yes.
And then usually the killer is the person you saw for 5 seconds somewhere in the movie.
Yeah. Because that's why I completely forgot about him. And I was, that's why I'm like, is it the teacher? Because he was in so little of the movie. And I think it was smartly done. But yeah, now going forward with Giallos, I'm going to be like, all right, who did I see the least in this movie? You're probably the killer.
And then you have some movies, and I don't want to say which one, because it's kind of a spoiler, that just show you who the killer is right away.
Exactly. So this one was hard to figure out. I was sure it was the uncle until they had that line of like, oh, it sounds like you're in the other room. And I was like, maybe it's not him because that feels like some, you know, I don't know. So the killer is revealed to be the teacher. And I was taking care of a fussy baby at this moment, which was not the right time to not have to, you know, not be paying attention to the movie, but I had a fussy baby in my lap. So what happened when this guy was a kid? Like some girls tricked him into pushing his friend off the cliff. Like what happened? I don't even remember.
So like, it is a weird,
it was like a 30 second situation. Thing too. It wasn't even like the reveal.
Yeah. He saw his brother fall to his death because he was trying to grab this creepy fucking doll off the cliff.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I'm reading the situation correctly, the doll was his, meaning the killer's.
Yes.
And like, he might have felt guilty about that because I thought it was like, you know, his brother was trying to grab his doll, which I feel like maybe might have been a whole thing of like, oh, I, you know, I shouldn't have been playing with dolls type of thing. But then wasn't it also like two young girls that were there?
Yeah, there was two young girls that he called like bitches because they tricked him into doing something. And again, this is like the one part of the movie I couldn't hear.
And then, but it gets even weirder because not only did that happen, but then two students seduced him into a threesome and were gonna like threaten for him to lose his job. So it's like, which, like, you're adding too much to this backstory.
Yeah.
Which is the reason why I would still argue for me personally that Black Christmas works a little bit better as a that killer has even less motive. He's just doing it because he wants to.
Exactly. Because he's insane. So, okay, from what I'm seeing in the synopsis on IMDb.
Also, I have to say that this movie has such an anticlimactic ending.
Kind of does, yeah. It really does. But it's poetic in a way because, so if this is correct from IMDb, it shows a flashback of a young Franz with his brother and girl. Brother and a girl. They're wishing to see the girl in intimate ways. The brother goes for the doll at the edge of the cliff, falls to his death. This made Franz see women who bring nothing but bad things for men. So he's just got a thing up for women.
This is a solid argument for men going to therapy.
For real. Go talk out your problems. Stop killing women because you have you hate all women. But he did not want to kill Danny, or he didn't want to kill Jane because, you know, she was pure. He's like, why are you here? You know, you shouldn't be here. I didn't want to have to kill you, but now that you've seen me, I have to kill you. And then who comes to the fucking rescue other than the doctor? Because he's somewhere in town where someone mentions that they were up there, but no one answered the door. They're like, oh, I guess, you know, they must have all left. So the doctor's like, it doesn't sound right. So he goes to check in on the situation and comes in at the nick of time, right when Franz is trying to kill Jane. And they have a pretty fun scuffle. But then he ends up falling to his death over the rocks. And I was like, you know, it was pretty anticlimactic. Yeah. They built it up and then it kind of fell flat. But I was like, man, that was poetic as shit.
Just like he did.
Yeah, exactly. But
I have to say, I love their little scuffle, and I was really amused when they got to the barn. It feels like they just went back in time. It's like, when did we get to this old-timey barn?
Like, what is this? What year is this from? So let's talk about some dislikes real quick, because we've already talked about that, like, most of the movie in pretty decent detail. So, fuck, what was one of the things one of the things I was not a fan of this movie is how it bounced around for like the first 20 minutes. You're introduced to all these fucking characters, barely any names are thrown out, and it doesn't really seem to have any fucking sort of narrative for like the first 15 minutes. Like, until like the first couple of killings happen, then we start following around Jane and Daniela, but I was like, how the fuck am I supposed to talk about this movie? Because the first 20 minutes are a mess, in my opinion. I was like, this is so chaotic. It's like, who are we following here? You follow Flo, who ends up dying, and so does the man she's having sex with in her car. And we follow around Carol, who was at this weird party where everyone's fucking and dancing and playing music, and then the killer gets her, and you're like, who are we following around here? So yeah. The movie really doesn't find its footing until they, like, leave the college town and go to the country home, and that's, like, 35, 40 minutes into the movie.
Yeah,
so,
it takes a while for it to find its story. It's, like, yeah. it's dispatching these girls at the beginning in ways that feel seemingly disconnected from the rest of the film.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
When they could have tightened all that up and just brought those girls with, I don't know. There's a lot that could have been,
yeah, that's
done differently. And then, like, none of the characters we really got a chance to get to know very well. Like, I was in the same boat as you. I figured Danny was going to be the lead character, right. And then Jane just kind of swoops in and, like, the true American she is, and takes the spotlight. and then there's just some things that were very weird to, like, hard to explain from a logic standpoint. Like, one, why the fuck does Jane have a car with Italian plates that say Chicago?
Did she really?
Yes. So it's like, wait, did they try to get her? But it looked like someone just painted the word Chicago on Italian plates. Oh. So it's like, are we supposed to believe that she got her car from America? And then, like, so everything I've ever heard about European countries is European countries have a different relationship with sex and nudity than America does. America's very prudish with that stuff, but and nudity is a fairly common thing.
Yeah.
But yet every guy just lost their fucking shit every time they saw these women.
Pretty much, yeah. And honestly, there was just too much nudity for me. You literally, after the title sequence, you literally pan down to boobs. And I'm like, we are 5 seconds into this movie. I like, holy, there's so many boobs, so much full frontal. And it's to the point where I'm like, I just don't need this much nudity. Like, unneeded nudity. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many times.
It's kind of dull.
Yeah.
Like, for that reason.
Yeah.
I'm honestly no prude, but it's not interesting.
Yeah. It's overdone. Fully
it's not
overdone.
Interesting. It doesn't feel necessary, as you said.
Yeah. If there was meaning to it, like, in the beginning, I understood they were taking photos. It was like a threesome. I'm like, okay, they're whatever. But, like, there's so many times, like, the three girls at one point are sitting outside the country home just naked tanning. And I'm like, this is so unnecessary to have in the movie. Like, there's no reason to have this at all. So that's my other problem. Too many boobs. And then the ending. Yeah. The ending's a little anticlimactic. So those are my three biggest issues with this movie. Not to say that I didn't enjoy it. There are some really good kills, but I feel like we really got screwed out of three excellent kills, because when Danny, Ursula, and the other chick, when Stefano is revealed that he's dead and he gets pushed in, all the girls scream, and then we just cut to the next day. We don't even get to we don't even get to see those three kills. I was like, ah, we got so screwed out of three amazing kills.
And, like, I get it, like, it's supposed to add some intrigue because you see the body being buried, but you don't know who's burying it. And
yeah,
I get that, but.
And he does hack him up the next day, which that was pretty, and, you know, fucking Jane is sitting behind them, you know, watching him saw these girls up. And I was like, okay, like, that's pretty fucked up and crazy. But yeah, I'm like, man, we missed out on, like, a great killing montage where he just massacred these three girls. It's like, damn.
And even, like, the cat and mouse between Jane and the killer was not as interesting as I was hoping it to be.
It was a little dull at that moment. It kind of fell down. I was like, okay, this is kind of being drug out a little too much. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like this movie has a lot of problems. I did enjoy it, though. Like, you know, it was at a certain level for me. And then the ending with how I thought it was pretty poetic, even though it was kind of paper thin. I gave it an extra half star for that. But, yes.
Yeah, I think it's a movie that might grow on me the more I watch it. But it's definitely not my favorite giallo.
No.
And it certainly is no Black Christmas.
No. Currently, Tenebrae holds my highest rating for giallo, as I still need to dive into this subgenre more. But Tenebrae is currently my favorite of all time. It's just so damn good. So good. So, yes, Torso from 1973, I do feel it meets all the qualifications that were laid out by Jim, I think, Vorle, what was your name? Even though I know he made the list.
Jim Vorle,
yeah. So, and then you added, you know, a nice touch with the, you know, defining feature mask something. So, this movie definitely follows everything, I feel. I feel like this could potentially be, you know, technically the first slasher to follow the rules laid out. But yeah, it's no Black Christmas. It's no, you know, it's no Tenebrae. I have plenty of other favorite slashers that I would watch before this one, but it's definitely something I want to revisit maybe a couple months down the road and just see if, you know, because sometimes sometimes movies just work differently for you at a different time in your life. I mean, Black Christmas is a huge example. I did not like that movie at all when I first watched it, and then I rewatched it, and I was like, this movie's fucking brilliant. So, you know, it takes... I don't think it's going to happen in this case with this movie, but I could have different feelings about it. Anything else you'd like to say about this before we wrap up and move on to the post-review section?
I guess what I would like to say is I think this movie has got a really interesting style to it. And that's kind of what kept me fascinated through most of the film. The way that Giancarlo Ferrando shoots this film, like I said, you know, there's times where it's almost very free with the way the camera moves, because they're in Italy a lot of time. I believe at this time they're using a little bit lighter weight cameras, but they were also not tethered to having sound, because movies in Italy were not shooting with sync sound. They would dub all the languages, even their native language, later on. So they could move the camera any which way they wanted. So there was a lot of handheld. There was a lot of times where it felt like the cameraman was getting really low, you know, probably on the ground. And there was just a lot of creativity with and very free movement of the camera. And that I found really interesting. And that's really what gave me those art house meets grindhouse vibes that I keep talking about. Is in a lot of ways how they move the camera, because, you know, you watch something like Blood Feast. I love Blood Feast. I love Herschel Gordon Lewis, but that man is not the most inept when it comes to camera work. And that's nothing against him. It's just that's not where his mind is focused.
Right.
But then you got something like this, where it sometimes it feels and looks a little bit like Blood Feast in the way that it's lit. Sometimes it's not always the most appealing in terms of its lighting, but the camera movement just shows a lot of shows how skilled Sergio Martino and his team were.
Yeah, I feel like they were a tightly knit group, especially with how much they worked together. So I can agree with that. Yeah, the movie definitely, the copy that I had, the Arrow version, looks great, shot great. So that's definitely, I feel like the biggest plus for this movie is how it looks and how it's presented. So yeah, definitely something I'll revisit at one point in my life, especially since I have the Arrow box set. But let's move on to post-review things here. I've got three taglines. There was like so many, but I only picked three. One day she met a man who loved a beautiful woman, but not all in one piece. That's fucking great. he'll love you to pieces, and death is the best keeper of secrets, which is one of your favorite lines. That is a great tagline. I love that. I've got one, two, three things of trivia here. The film was highly censored in English language countries. Because of this, parts of the English dub do not exist for the film. On uncut DVDs, these scenes are played with their original Italian language track and English subtitles, which I assume is what the English/Italian version is. During production, none of the cast were told who the killer was, and because of the high amount of red herrings in the film, many of the actresses were convinced it was someone else doing all the murders. That's very... I think Scream, the original Scream, did that. I'm pretty sure. I don't think they told people who the killer was.
And yeah, that is a trend that happens sometimes with some of these films. They'll keep the last X amount of pages a secret, just so that way at any point the performances can hopefully reflect that level of uncertainty.
Yeah, which is really cool. I like that. So Quentin Tarantino showed his print of the film at the 1999 QT Fest. His fellow filmmaker Eli Roth has cited the film among his favorite Jolly, and an influence on Grindhouse and Hostel Part 2, which is why I feel that one guy I mentioned was the Italian detective in Hostel Part 2 probably got the job because he loved this movie so much.
Probably Eli Roth does that quite a bit in a way that, like, say Rob Zombie will cast a lot of, forgotten American actors. Eli Roth will do that a lot of Italian actors.
Okay. All right. So rated 6.5 out of 10 on IMDb, 3.4 out of 5 on Letterboxd, 56% on the tomato meter, and a 54% audience score. This was at a 3 for me, but I did, even though it was anticlimactic, I enjoyed the poetic ending of him dying the way his brother did, even though that sounds fucked up. So I ended up giving it a 3.5 out of 5. What did you rate this movie, or what would you rate this movie?
I gave it a 3.
Okay, yeah, and like I said, I was at a 3.
I can see it maybe going up a little bit, but yeah. I think it's kind of within that range.
Okay. Perfect. Similar movies according to Letterboxd, we have The New York Ripper, Tenebrae, High Tension, Urban Legend, and The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. And similar movies according to IMDb, we have The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward, Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key, All the Colors of the Dark, A Bay of Blood, and The Case of the Scorpion's Tale. And since we're talking about fun giallo titles, I've got some for you real quick. Yeah. All right. A Lizard in Woman's Skin, The House with the Laughing Windows, Murder to the Tune of Seven Black Notes.
Ooh, that's a good one.
I love that one. Strange Shadows in an Empty Room. Love and Death in the Gardens of the Gods. Nine Guests for a Crime. Black Belly of the Tarantula. Seven Blood-Stained Orchids. The Forbidden Photos of a Lady Above Suspicion. Such a long title. Such a long title. And So Sweet, So Dead.
One of those remind me of a Spanish giallo film I saw one time where it was The Killer is One of 13.
Yes! Giallo titles, like, who started the trend of like, all right, guys, we have to make these titles ridiculously awesome, because I love going, there's a list of 150 giallo titles, and I was like, these are all so amazing. I was like,
used to be a website, I don't know if it's still around, where I think it was called Giallo or Not, and it would just come up with weird titles, and you have to guess if it was a real title or not.
I love it! That would be really hard, honestly. I think that would be very tough. Did you find any reviews?
I did!
All right. I've got four or five here. They're pretty short.
I got like eight.
Oh my God. All right. Let's burn through these real quick.
All right. I'm going to go with my longest one first. It's okay. Actually a longer one, but I cut it. Because I didn't want to read the whole thing.
All right.
It says, this is from a Letterboxd by a person named Gentry. They gave it 4 stars and a heart. Get on the tractor, girls. We're going to the villa overlooking the town square to study for our final exams and escape the carnal violence of a masked serial killer. Title is misleading. Torsos are dismembered, but this is ultimately the story of female friendship and two star-crossed lovers brought together by fate. It didn't intend to be a proto-slasher. It sort of stumbled into it, but the codes are all there. There's the prototype for the final girl, but not actually one, as she ultimately needs saving. A youthful collegiate setting, leering boys, and the horror of discovering the bodies of your friends. But do I think those going into this expecting the mood of a slasher will be disappointed? Most of the killing is off screen, and the students we follow aren't that funny or interesting beyond the cute same-sex relationship. It goes on from there, but I thought that first part was great.
Oh, that is great. All right, let's see here. My first one, 4 stars from Slay Gal. I don't know what's going on, to be fair, but I enjoyed it. And I was like, that's how I felt for the first half an hour. I was like, I don't know what's happening. This is very weird. Go ahead.
This next one is from a cat. It's cat with a K, and there's a little spider at the end of their name.
Oh.
4 stars and a heart.
Ooh.
Psychopathic killer with SM mask and doll trauma slashes bare boobed goofy girls in a small Italian village. Soft porn meets giallo meets slasher prototype. You describe torso like this or something similar. That's exactly what I want to see.
All right. I've got a 5-star from Sweeney Tom that says, I have a sincerely stupid amount of admiration for that foggy forest scene, and I fucking concur with that. I love that scene. It was so good.
So then these next ones are all going to be bad reviews.
Oh, okay.
1/2-star by Watson Weviews.
Jesus.
A scarf? A scarf? Even the knife kills are lame. Borderline incomprehensible at parts.
Damn. All right. I've got a 2.5-star from HH Review. It's your typical giallo, boobs, some blood, boobs, mystery, boobs, red herrings, boobs, creepy killer, and more boobs. Also, did I mention boobs? It's like, yeah.
There's going to be a whole, I got a whole trend of, of those types of reviews coming up.
Oh, shit.
This next one is by a guy named Super Relax. Gave it 1 star. Instead of torso, they should have called this movie Breasts.
Yes. All right, my last one here, 2.5 stars from Finchering. Shopping around town using a tractor with BFFs, easily entering my bucket list.
That was actually one of my unsung favorite scenes.
Yeah, I was like, dude, I have to go shopping with the fucking giant tractor.
Amanda says, that feels weirdly American.
Oh, fuck shit.
This next one is by Beck, C696. One star. Good music, lots of titty rubbing.
Good music, lots of titty rubbing. Good grief.
I got a couple more if you got time.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
This one is by Zinzanuli.
All right.
1.5 stars. Fun fact, it's called Torso because you get to see a lot of titties.
Honestly, that's why I feel like they renamed it in America.
This next one is called F. Moron or Moran. I'm not sure. I think it's Moran. F. Moran, 93, 1.5 stars. This movie tittied harder than most, but was still mostly unwatchable. I'm starting to think I just don't like giallos.
I mean, hey, that's fair. If giallos aren't your thing,
tittied harder than most.
Tittied harder.
Okay, I got one more.
All right, do it to it.
I also appreciate that most of these reviews are coming from women. I don't know why I find that really amusing. This next one is by Zira. This is not a horror movie. Sergio Martino needs therapy. End of the review.
Okay. Goodness. All right. Michael, where can people hear the sultry sound of your voice on your podcast?
You can find my podcast, The Shameless Picture Show, on everywhere you listen to podcasts, but you can also find us on cinepunks.com. That's CinePunx.com. Cinepunks, we are about to start our yearly Cineween spectacular. Nice. Where we have a bunch of spooky ass content. So shows like Cinema Smorgasbord or Cinepunks or Twitch of the Death Nerve or Tomb of Ideas, they're all gonna put out some spooky content.
Yeah.
On top of that, we're gonna have a bunch of spooky articles coming up, and I'm writing a piece right now about the very extremely underseen movie Frankenstein and Me.
Yes, I can't wait to read that. I'm so excited to read that.
But you can, like I said, you can find it all everywhere podcasts can be heard. And then I'm on TikTok where I do physical media reviews. I just did a deep dive of this Severin Christopher Lee box set.
Nice. Very nice.
And I think you'd find me at Shameless Picture Show. And then I'm pretty much Michael_Virus everywhere else.
I love it. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Slasher App at Frightmares Podcast. Our email is stayspookyoutlook.com. You can follow me personally on Letterboxd at Dr. Proctor. You are Viers 10-2008.
Oh, shit.
Yes! I did it. Next week, me and Gabby will be back doing what I consider very underrated slasher from 2011. So until then, stay tuned and stay spooky.